Thank you. As he says, I'm Christine Duffy. I'm part of Lutheran Social Services, and I work particularly in the Center for New Americans program, which works with refugees and immigrants. And so what I'm going to share with you today first is really an overview of the whole process. Who are refugees? How do they end up in America and around the world, and what happens to them, and how does LSS work with them? So that's what I'm going to share with you. And if you have any questions, let me know. I'll be around afterwards. And then I will also explain how Lutheran Social Services works with them. So the very first thing I want to talk about, though, is really clearing up the difference between an immigrant and a refugee. I feel a lot of times when I go out and talk with people and what I see in the media is sometimes everything gets lumped together or it gets mixed up. So I put two definitions up there, but an immigrant is really just a general term. It's someone who goes and lives in another country, and it could be for a thousand different reasons. It could be for family. You got married, or your relatives live there, and you're going to join them, or for school, or for work, or you know what? Germany just sounds like fun, so I'm going to go live there, for whatever reason. But a refugee, on the other hand, is a special definition. It comes from the United Nations, and you have to fit this category after an interview and a screening process. If you don't fit this definition, you can't be a refugee. And that is a person who has faced persecution due to their race, religion, nationality, or membership in a political or social group. So if you don't fit one of those five categories, you're not a refugee. They face that persecution, and they are forced from their home country, and they cannot return. So it's not really a choice for them. I kind of point that out. The main difference is refugees don't choose to leave. Immigrants do. Next slide. I'm actually going to just skip this so you can go right through it. Every time I go out and do a presentation like this, I always ask my audience to walk in the footsteps of a refugee. So I have four questions that will pop up, and I just want you to kind of reflect on them, and then I will tell you the story of one of my coworkers, just show you a real life example. But the first question is, what would you do if you had minutes to flee your home? It's very hard to imagine, but what if there were militias and bombs going off in Sioux Falls everywhere? What would you do? And how would you survive on the run when you left? If you thought, it's too dangerous here in Sioux Falls, I cannot live here anymore, where would you go and how would you get there and what would you take with you? And surviving on the run, what does that look like? And this one can be very difficult, but think about, could you say goodbye to your loved ones, your family, friends, coworkers, people you see on a daily basis, your neighbors? You know, what if you don't get a hold of them? What if you're separated from them? And finally, where could you start over again? And kind of a sub-question, how easy would it be for you to start all over again? So my coworker is from a country, South Sudan. At 7 years old, she was living in this small village with her family, and one night the militia came to the village. And she remembers waking up in the middle of the night. She could hear gunfire going off. She could see the flickering of flames out the window. She smelled smoke. And when she looked for her family, they were missing. All of her brothers and sisters, her parents, she doesn't know what happened to them. But she's heard of stories of what happens when the militia came through. Rape, killing, torture. So she knew, I have to leave. And so she ran, and she saw a whole bunch of other people from her village running towards the woods, and she followed them. And after about a day of traveling, she happens in the crowd to see her aunt, one of her aunts, and some of her cousins. And so she runs up, and there's a happy, like, oh, you're alive, all of this. And so they continue along with all the others. It took them 3 months to walk from the village in South Sudan to Kenya to a refugee camp called Kakuma. And it's there that she connected with the United Nations. They interviewed her. They talked all about the definition. And they granted her refugee status. And so they allowed her to live in the camp with her aunt. But technically, you know, her aunt never adopted her. So, you know, she's considered unaccompanied minor. And at the age of 17, after 10 years of living in the camp, The United Nations gave her the option to be resettled into America. You know, you've ever heard of the Lost Boys of South Sudan? She was one of the lost girls. It's a category no one really talks about. There were a lot of girls who were displaced as well. So she ended up here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, went to high school for a little bit, eventually made her way through college and started working at Lutheran Social Services. But all of these things she had to go through at the young age of 7. Where am I going to go? What am I going to do? What do I take with me? Now I have no supplies. How do I get food along the way? And coming to the United States, she didn't speak English before. In the camp, they really don't have education. So coming here, she learned English all over again. She somehow put herself through college. She was secretly working overnights at John Morrell when she went to Lincoln High School. Her teachers didn't like that when they found out because she kept falling asleep during class. But, you know, at 17 and 18 years old, she has to navigate an entire new country, new way of life. And so it's not always that easy to just pick up the pieces and start over. So I believe my next couple slides are just some pictures of the journey, but of the death boats in the Mediterranean. And I think the best quote of these things is, how dangerous is the place that you are that is the safest option for your child? The long journeys, taking everything that you have with you. Children, 51% of refugees are under the age of 18. So that story of my coworker is a very common one. They've also seen lots of violence, seen war, seen trauma, seen atrocities, been tortured, been raped. So they not only do they have to start over, but they have all this psychological and counseling stuff that they would need to go through too. So we'll move on. These are the numbers that we have right now. We should get the year total for 2016 very soon. But 21.3 million refugees around the world. And those are the ones that only fit that five category thing. On top of that, there are just other people who are displaced. And it's not because of their race, their religion, things like that. That's another 40.8 million people around the world. So in total, displacement is 65 million people. That's a huge number. It's really hard to fathom, really. That's like, I believe, like two New York states or something like that. Yeah, something like that. They have like 32 million people in their state. So two New York states. Yeah, it's about 24 people every single minute. So I think, what, we have about 50 people here. So in 2 minutes, this whole room would be cleared on average. I mentioned that most are under the age of 18. And another 25% are women. So 75% of refugees are the very vulnerable populations. They're not what the media likes to present, that they're the young, strapping men all by themselves. That's a small minority of them. These numbers that we're seeing are the highest that we've ever seen, and it's been a 52% increase in the last 5 years. When I first started 3 years ago, the numbers I were quoting was about 14 million refugees and only 40 million people displaced. And in just 3 years, I have to update this every single year because there's always more. And this one surprises people, I think. Most refugees are actually hosted in the developing regions of the world. These are actually the top six hosting countries. This is where most refugees are residing right now. There are about 2.5 million in Turkey alone. Most of the places that they are, their countries have a gross domestic product of about $6,000. In comparison, the United States has a gross domestic product per person of about $64,000. So the countries that they're living in face extreme poverty for their own people, let alone all these undocumented immigrants or outsiders who are in their countries. So where they're coming from right now is the Middle East is one. I'll show you a map. Most of the refugees that South Dakota sees out of the Middle East are Iraqi refugees or Afghani refugees, not Syrian. I know that's really in the media right now, but it's really those other two countries. Things in Afghanistan have been going on since 1979, and there are people who are still displaced. They've been displaced for 40 years. How many times has things happened in Iraq in the 1970s when Saddam took over, in the 1980s, in the early 90s, in the early 2000s, and then today with ISIS in the northern part? It's displaced If you can see, it's kind of a little blurry. At the top of Iraq, there's a town called Mosul. It's the second largest city in Iraq. They've displaced 1.5 million people because ISIS took over that. And now the Iraqi forces and the American forces are there trying to clear them out and to allow people to go back home. But in that in itself is causing more people to be displaced because there's fighting and there's more bombs going off. So it's a continual thing. To give you a perspective of a refugee camp, this is just one refugee camp in Jordan, and I see some jaws dropping, and it might drop further when I say there's 140,000 people in this one camp alone. So it's comparable to Sioux Falls, basically. The interesting thing, though, is that this is basically run by nonprofits and like humanitarian efforts, UNICEF, Doctors Without Borders, United Nations, World Food Program. So, you know, unlike Sioux Falls, where we generate taxes and we sustain it ourselves, these are not sustainable things. They always need outside efforts to come in. And as these crises grow exponentially around the country, around the globe, we, you know, Doctors Without Borders needs to be more places. But are they getting more funding for that? Probably not. Everything like that. So that's just in the Middle East. Now we're going to fly over to Southeast Asia. And this one is another surprising one because everyone's like, what's happening in Southeast Asia? It's like really nice there. And it is, but this is stuff that started back in the 1970s, 1980s. The little tiny country of Bhutan up in the left-hand corner, and then the red country, Burma. We're seeing individuals from those two countries as well. Basic summary is for Bhutan, there was a subset, a different ethnic group that lived in Bhutan for centuries. And in 1980, in late 1980s, the government enacted a policy called One People, One Country. And basically said, if you don't practice our religion, if you don't speak our language, if you're not ethnically, like generations ago, Bhutanese, you can get out of our country. We're going to strip away every single right. You have no right to get married, no right to go to school, no right to practice. The women of this other ethnic group would have longer hair. The Bhutanese are Buddhist, and they usually wear short hair. So they would forcibly cut off women's hair. You know, just something like that, which, you know, it's not as traumatic maybe as rape or something, but to forcibly do that for individuals. And so 100,000 individuals of that ethnic group left in the early 90s and were placed in two camps. They ended up in Nepal. And it wasn't until 2008 that the world turned around and said, oh, we'll help you. Come to our country. So they sat in that camp for about 15, almost 20 years before the world turned around. In comparison, you know, the Syrian war is only 6 years old, and right away, other countries are stepping up and saying, come, we're going to help you, and things like that. So it's not as quick as some people like to think. It can take a long time. Next picture is just kind of inside one of the camps in Thailand, but I just kind of like showing what up close. And then Africa is the last area that we see refugees come from. And there's, we work with Sudan and South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and a little country called Eritrea. And since no one knows Eritrea, I always like to talk about it, but it's been nicknamed the North Korea of Africa. It is a dictatorship. It's been a dictatorship since it gained its independence from Ethiopia in 1992. It has one newspaper, one TV station, one political party. It's all controlled by the president. There's no internet. You don't get to see outside sources. You can't speak out about it. And at the age of 18, you're inscripted into a government service, which doesn't end. So if you're a male, that means you go to war. And if you're a woman, you work a government job. So most of the people fleeing Eritrea are 16, 17 years old, which leaves a whole generation of people who don't have parents to teach them how to be adults and things like that. So you have, you know, basically lost children again as well from this country. And this next one, if the last refugee camp made your mouth drop, this picture will hopefully do even more. This is Dadaab. It is the world's largest refugee camp. It is in Kenya, near the border of Somalia. It's been around since 1991, like April 1991. And it has 400,000 people in it, approximately. So immensely huge. the refugee camps themselves. It's a very polite way when I say rough conditions. Hearing stories, some of my coworkers lived in these camps. Just the other day, one had talked about he was living there as a young gentleman and met one of the aid workers from Norway, and she had fallen in love with him. And he kept saying no to her because he's like, what am I supposed to do, bring her back to this ramshackle hut that has, like, holes and stuff? Like, we can't be together. So he was telling me this weird kind of love story, but he described the camp that way. He also talks about the violence and just... There's no fences on that place, so people can come in and try and steal supplies. And so he and some of the other men in their, like, row of tents would set up, like, nightly patrols to keep everyone safe. And so they'd walk around and everything. There are very little opportunities for work and healthcare, education in camps. Each place is different, but some have a high school academy, and so you can go up to that, but some are, you know, maybe it's first or second grade, basically, would be the equivalent. The next two statistics are probably the hardest ones as well, and it's a little difficult to read, but it says 75% of refugees remain in camps for more than 5 years. This is actually becoming more like a 10-year stay for most people. In Dadaab alone, you have generations. You have individuals who entered as a baby or were born there and who are now in their early 20s having kids of their own. So some of them don't even know what their homeland is like. They've only known the camp. That's what it is. And just based upon different lengths, the average length that you're displaced out of a home is about 17 years. So this is a very, very long process. The next are just a bunch of pictures of the camps. You got water lines. Most camps are in deserts, really, really, really bad areas that, you know, nothing grows. You have to truck in the water. You have to truck in supplies. Food is typically like a once a month cycle. You go and you get your ration card and you get your food, and hopefully it lasts till the next truck comes. The food itself is like rice and grains and beans, lentils, you know, it's really basic things that don't spoil. The fresh food, fresh vegetables, fresh meat, that's pretty rare. And so with the lack of health care available, and then you compound it with poor nutrition, where you're not getting a well-balanced diet, just means that any conditions like diabetes or cancer or anything like that are just going to get worse. Most refugees actually don't live in a camp. So those huge numbers of camps are just like only 40% of the world's refugee population. Most live in urban areas, either in like abandoned buildings where they set up little tents and live in squalid conditions, or they spend what little money that they were able to take with them on rent to pay for a place in places like Lebanon or Jordan, different places like that. This is just a street in Congo of one of the camps. And then, as I mentioned, children have seen lots of violence. So if you go to the next one, this picture was floating around Facebook for the last couple of years. This is a girl from Syria. She was, I believe, about 3 years old at this time. And so all she knows is war. Gunfire is going off. And so this individual is taking a picture. And to her, it looked like a gun. And all she learned from, you know, from age zero is that if I do this, they will hopefully not hurt me. So she's better. She's gotten counseling, and I don't know where she ended up, but she's about five or six right now. So when I talked about school, this is one school. This is actually in Kakuma, so they have desks. They cram a lot of people in there. But the next picture is another type of school, and it's just a chalkboard outside with a teacher, which are usually volunteers, either from like the Red Cross or UNICEF, or it's just a volunteer from the camp. One of the parents or one of the people in there is teaching classes. So not only when they do come over and having to learn another language, think about all the content that we're able to teach our children, all the technology and resources we have, and the educational background that they come in. They have a lot of catching up to do. So I hope all of these pictures and kind of this explanation helps you understand why resettlement is a needed thing in the world. And resettlement was created after World War II, actually, when about 200,000 Europeans were displaced. And so the United Nations High Commission for Refugees was created. And what they did is they worked with 30 countries around the world. They all signed this declaration saying that we're not only going to help by giving humanitarian aid around the world, we're also going to take in people. And so I need to change my number. It's actually 30 countries around the world resettle refugees. Each country is allowed to say how many that they will take. And so for the United States, every October when they set the budget, they set the ceiling for the next fiscal year. And so in October, the last administration set this latest one at 110,000 refugees for the 2017 fiscal year. In a strange move, the newest administration decided in that latest travel ban to reduce the ceiling from 110,000 people to 50,000, which is a decrease of about 65%. To give you an example, last year, in the 2016 fiscal year, 85,000 refugees came to the United States. So even just from the year before, it's a decrease of about 35,000 people. In total, around the world, if you add up all the refugees who go through the process of resettlement, it's only about 200,000 people, which is less than 1% of the world's refugee population. It's a very, very small amount. It's just like a drop in the hat. Or a bucket, not a hat. I always mess up my idioms and things like that. I once said I'm not the sharpest crayon in the box. Which, if you think about it, as a child, you want the sharp crayons. So I feel like I just created a new idiom. But they didn't agree with me. So they just laughed. But going back, so when I said each country not only gets to set their number of people that they take in each year, they also get to set the screening process, how long everything takes, what the requirements are. So out of all the countries, the United States has the hardest screening process to go through. And then within the United States itself, this is actually the hardest screening process for anyone trying to enter, whether it's you're a student, a tourist visa, fiancé visa, work visa. The refugee visa is the hardest thing to actually go through. The State Department will like to tell you that it takes 2 years. And actually, they up this number to 36 months. You actually talk to people working in this process and the refugees themselves. It's more like, on average, at least 4 to 5 years. And for most people, it's closer to a 10-year process. And if there's any doubt in the screening processes, they will reject the case. So I have a handy-dandy infographic that goes through the steps. So the very first step is you must connect with the United Nations or a U.S. embassy. So for the individuals like in Iraq and Afghanistan who are soldiers who are working or like interpreters working with the United States government, like the whether they're interpreting or they're working like special forces, the army can then refer them to the embassy and go through this process. If you're just a regular old refugee who's not working with the United States government, the UN, you have to interview with them, get this designation, and then they have to decide that your case is the most vulnerable. You don't get to sign up for refugee. You don't get to sign up for resettlement. There's no list. And you're like, I've been here a month, and I'm tired of being here. Send me to America. So they typically will do children and women and victims of torture. Those are kind of their high-priority individuals. And so they decide which country out of the world. They say, oh, okay, well, Australia's taking some. We think they should go there. Or the United States. Okay. So they refer them to the United States. And that is when the Homeland Security takes over. So the UN should have had all this information from your interviews, any paperwork that you brought, as well as any documentation. You know, you've lived their last 20 years of your life. They have documentation of that. So they begin investigating your case even more, adding to it, running you through security clearances. Usually you're going through at least 3 different security clearance checks. Basically, they're looking for any reason to say no. You have connections to known bad actors. You have a criminal history in the country that you either came from or that you visited. And the connection to known bad actor, which, you know, when you first think you're like, oh, yeah, if you're part of any terrorist group or like a bad thing, yeah, of course. But that could be something as simple as the militia came to your village and at gunpoint or knife point forced you to give them food and shelter. That's aiding an enemy army. And that can throw your case out. And that's I've happened to family members of people who are living here. They've told me stories like that. Are my eyes like blurry or is it? Okay, good. I wasn't sure. I need new context, so I was just checking. But during this, during those security clearance checks, it not just goes through Homeland Security. It actually goes through 8 government agencies like FBI, FBI, Counterterrorism, State Department, Defense Department, United States Citizen and Immigration. So they're all adding to this using their contacts around the world. And if there's any reason that they say no, they throw out your case. If there's not a reason they've said no at this stage, then you move on and you actually get an in-person interview. You actually get to talk to someone, not just they look at your paperwork. So you typically go your whole family. So, you know, if I went and I had spouse and children, we'd all go together, maybe even my parents if they were there. And what they would do is they take everyone over the age of 14 into a separate room. And for hours, they would interrogate you based upon all the information that they have. And these guys are trained to trip you up. They're trained interrogators, so they're going to change details in your story. They're going to flip dates around, switch things around. So if you just agree with them, yeah, that's what I said last time. Oh, no, that's not what you said. You said your birthday was a different day. Why are you lying to us? Why are you trying to fraud us? And that can throw out your case. So, I mean, you really have to know your story. You really have to continually say the same thing. And usually it's 3 to 4 rounds of these interviews for hours and hours at a time. During these visits, they also fingerprint you. They photograph you again. For if you have family, they do DNA testing to make sure that those children are actually yours. They're not just some strangers that are trying to hitch a ride. This is a new thing that has been implemented, but when the Syrians started connecting with the United Nations, they actually began scanning all their retinas and creating a database. And so during these interviews, if you had already had your retina scanned, they scan them again. All of this is to make sure that the very first person who connected, that we know are refugees, have made it to this stage. They're also, again, running those fingerprints and photographs against other databases. Like in Iraq, they've created facial databases and fingerprint databases from investigations of attacks and things like that. Again, this is basically the stage if they have found a reason to say no, that they're going to say no and throw out your case. If they really haven't found any reason to say no, they're going to give you a conditional yes. I'm like, yes for now. You go on for medical screenings, which sometimes will throw out your case, sometimes communicable diseases. Back in the past, like the 60s and 70s, if you were elderly or disabled in any way, sorry, you're not coming to the United States. It was something as simple as that. Now they don't do that, but I've seen a few who've gotten thrown out at this stage. And then step 7 is for the adults, they're going to go learn about America. They don't come just blind. They teach them about America. You know, America values independence, freedom. You have the right to choose your religion, to marry who you want, to work. You have to work. You have to pay taxes. It's one of those like comedy news shows, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, actually went overseas to Jordan and sat in on one of these. So if you're interested to see kind of what it's like, you can check that out. But yeah, they're trying to prepare you for what's going to happen along your journey and stuff. Step 8, again, hard to read, but this is where your travel is added. So after you are approved, you basically go back either to the camp or where you were and sit until you get notification that you are going to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or somewhere, Alaska, or wherever you get placed. A plane ticket is bought on your behalf, and you will typically fly right to your destination. Like if you come to Sioux Falls, you fly here and we meet you. Some places, like if you're going to Huron, you fly here and then we drive you out, but you'll typically fly to your destination. The interesting thing about this plane ticket is it's not free for them. They do sign a promissory note in order to get the plane ticket saying that I will pay back the cost of this plane ticket. It's one of those, it sustains the process. You know, the refugees arriving now are going to pay for people who arrive down the road. And then the United States arrival is step 9, the very last stage. So we greet them right at the airport and handle their whole case. We help integrate them into America, help them get jobs and everything. All throughout this stage, there are security clearances that are continually being run. And so even you go through customs, if something pops up, they can turn you around and you get sent back on a plane. So it's a pretty, like I said, it's a very, very stringent, very hard, difficult process to make it through. And all of those security clearances, those interviews, the fingerprints, the orientation, they all have time limits too. And so people have asked about the executive order and how it's going to pause refugee resettlement for 120 days, 4 months basically. And why is that such a hard thing? Well, it's hard for the people who are in the pipeline. It doesn't necessarily affect the people who are here, nor does it affect what we are doing. We're still going to help. However, some of those things have a 90-day time limit. So if you started this process and now this ban happens, you have to go back through everything again and add years onto your thing. So it really has concrete now effects on people who are this close to beginning a new life. So that's the whole thing. You can find that at whitehouse.gov. You might have to find like an old version of it because they are redoing a lot of the White House websites and taking things off different pages. But I know you can Google it and find it. So what LSS does, so that's how they get here. The next one, what we do, we have very client-centered services. I guess in between that, you might ask, well, why Sioux Falls? Why choose Sioux Falls? How do they get here? Well, this is the work of the federal government. Sioux Falls is a great community. We're large enough that there are things here, there are jobs available, there's housing available, but small enough that it's a really nice place. You know, same reason you guys live here is probably the reason it's a good place for refugees to be resettled. We don't really have a huge crime rate. People are friendly. You know, tornadoes and winter scares them, but other than that, it's a pretty nice place. But the federal government is up here, and they approve everyone, and then they work with agencies at the next level. And all of these agencies have a web of resettlement sites like LSS, physical ones where there are people there who will help them across the United States. And so they sit and decide where each family is going to go. The biggest reason the United States says yes to people is to reunify them. So if your spouse, you were separated from your spouse, and now your spouse and your children are coming, they're going to be sent to be with you, or parents or siblings, cousins even. So they try to reunify families as much as possible. Some medical concerns might warrant you to be in a different part of the United States than others. And then they also look at the demographics of the community. A question, you know, does Sioux Falls see Syrian refugees? Not really, because we don't have a lot of Syrian people here, the people who have immigrated over the last 10, 20, 30 years. So they don't have family members who have made it through the pipeline yet, so they have not arrived here yet. That's one reason. But then also, we don't have a large Arabic community. For those individuals who don't have family members in the United States and they're like the first person, they try and get you into places where that community already exists to just kind of help take you under their wing, and it makes the transition a little bit easier for you. So we're not a first stop for Syrian refugees. So those are the three ways that they decide. And so we get everyone and we go meet them. We go through orientation with them again. We explain what the next 8 months to a year of their life is going to look like, what they need to do to be eligible for services, what their responsibilities are. We do this one-on-one within their first 24 hours. We do this at 30 days. We go and go through all of this again. And then we also have a class that every adult over the age of 18 must attend. We cover 15 different topics, and we bring people from the community to explain these things. Like a police officer comes, talks about interacting with the law, calling 911, when to call 911, when not to call 911, different legal matters. We bring in a doctor. We bring in the school district. We bring in people from employment agencies to talk about finding jobs. We even bring in a banker to talk about managing money and creating budgets and how to live and save here in the United States. I teach days about renting apartments and safety, and so we talk about, you know, fire alarms and keeping those. the dangers of keeping chemicals with food and the differences. You know, I hold up a bottle of Pine Sol and a bottle of Gatorade, which happen to be the same color, and we talk about why, you know, if you can't read English or if you're a child, you might just grab one and start drinking, not knowing the dangers there. And then, like I said, we talk about weather. And in summer, they don't believe that minus 40 is a real temperature that's going to happen. And then during winter, they don't believe that summer will ever happen. So, and then I terrify them with something called tornadoes, that they're going to come. But what happens if I'm outside and this and this? I'm like, it's okay. I just need to teach you about it. It doesn't happen that often, but just be ready. And then I realized I scared someone too much because the monthly sirens went off for like testing. And they were like, I know what to do, and like ran downstairs. But then they never came out for like 45 minutes. And then they had to call their a friend and like, is it safe to come out? Like, what happened? And so I clarified a little bit more about that. We want to teach them and get them ready to do things on their own. Self-sufficiency is the goal in all of this. So to do this, they do have caseworkers who help them. Someone helps them line up housing, helps them fill out the application, teaches them how do you pay your rent. They don't get free apartments, free houses, things like that. They same rent just like you and I. The medical specialist works through the same thing, taking them to the doctor's office, showing them how to check in, how to go to the doctor, how to make appointments, how to go to the pharmacy, how to get your kid enrolled into the school so they can go to school. The cash assistance specialists, what they do is, as a refugee, the federal government will help with assistance for 8 months. And it's a maximum of 8 months. There's no going past it. And if you get a job before 8 months, the assistance stops. It depends on how many people are in your case, who you live with. Like if you came here to join a spouse who already has a job, you probably won't get the assistance if they make too much. There are income guidelines. If you are familiar or if you want to look up the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, if it's called, here in South Dakota, it's the exact same standards. So what one person would get is what a refugee would get. Give you an example, three people, about $550 each month. To pay rent, utilities, transportation, phone bill, food, cleaning supplies, toiletries, anything like that. And then the last group is the employment team. They walk them through the stages of employment, getting them into job training classes, kind of talking, have you had a job before? Okay, what kind of jobs were they? Well, these are jobs that you are eligible for. And applying at different places and just following up. Most of our clients that we work with have a job before 6 months. 91% have it by 8 months. That 9% that don't have a job by 8 months are typically spouses or the very, very elderly who, you know, they're like 80 years old and they're not going to be able to work at John Morrell or something like that. So, but they typically have family members here who are willing and able to support them so they don't need any assistance afterwards. So they go very, very quickly, typically within 6 months to a year, we don't really see them at needing case management help anymore. But they could always come back for it. They can have it for 5 years. The assistance is only 8 months. The last three on my list, these are open to anyone in the community. You don't have to be a refugee, and there's no time limit. So we have adult education services, and our biggest one is English as a second language. So we're going through, you know, if you have no English ability whatsoever, or you're very high, you can have a conversation with on a day-to-day basis, but maybe you don't know the intricate grammar or some of the, like, idioms and slang words, like the sharpest crayon in the box kind of thing. So we're going through all different levels of that. We have classes all times of the day. We have some night times. We also do the job training classes and citizenship prep classes too. So if you want to become a United States citizen, besides the application and the legal fees, you actually have to take a test. And these are things that probably most of us learned back in like fourth grade. Easy things like how many states are there? Who's the president? Or harder things like who wrote the Federalist Papers? Anyone know? Oh, yes. There were several. But yeah, Alexander Hamilton was one of the people. And Madison, yeah. Which you ask most people, they are like, what are the Federalist Papers? It's like an episode of Jeopardy. Or like, who is the head of the Supreme Court? like the chief Supreme Court justice, which I didn't know. And so I actually feel kind of dumb when I help out in those classes. And so then I'm just like, let's just practice reading these words right now. And then we'll ask the teacher later. And so these classes, all of them are free. And you can take them as long as you need. If it takes you 7 years to go from no English to fluent, then that's how long it takes you. And as an adult, it can take a very long time, especially, you know, you're 80, 90 years old, and it's very hard to remember things. But we have a dedicated elderly population who are there every single day, and they are so excited to learn English. And there's one gentleman, he's 93, and he loves talking with people, like loves it, but he doesn't have a lot of English. And so he'll just switch to the next language he knows and just continue talking to you. And he's very funny. And somehow I understand his, like, I get he's telling a joke, even though I have no idea what he's saying. So, but he's very funny. So his caseworker's desk is right next to mine. And so he's very punctual. He knows when he's got appointments, and he'll come up. And, like, when she's not there, he's trying to explain to me to remind her that he has an appointment tomorrow. And so he's, like, pointing. And I'm like, oh, eye doctor. Okay, yeah. Tomorrow? Okay. And then he'll usually show me the card. I'm like, I'll tell her. And he's like, okay. And then he hands me cough drops because he thinks they're candy. And then says, bye-bye. So he's so adorable. I love him. And then our last two, we have attorneys who help in immigration counseling, getting green cards, going through the process to become a citizen. For those who were separated in the resettlement process or, you know, the refugee process, you can do petitions to get family members. So if your children are left behind, that's what one of my best friends is going through. He's trying to get his wife and his children who are separated from him. And it's been almost a 3-year process. And they were finally approved, and then the new executive orders went through. So he might have to wait a little bit longer. They were supposed to be here about this time, so we're still waiting on them. And then our last one is community interpreters. And so this one, you know, if you work out in the community, this one might be one that you become familiar with. We have about 40 different languages that are covered by interpreters, and they go out to, like, doctor's appointments, parent-teacher conferences, anything that people need to understand exactly what's going on. Even in our orientation, we bring an interpreter, so they're not just guessing at what I'm saying. They actually understand what I'm actually saying. So they go out and help while they're learning English and everything like that too. So that's what we do in a nutshell. We try and get them self-sufficient. Ways that we partner with people to get involved, there's a variety of things. Really concrete ways is volunteering. And I am volunteer coordinator, so that's why I like talking about this. But in our classrooms, we do have teachers who are certified. They come up with lesson plans. But in some classes, we have 40 people. And so we need volunteers to just kind of help. They might be doing small groups, working on worksheets, flashcards, or just even having practice conversations. So you have a list of 10 questions. You say, how are you today? And then they have to respond. And then they ask you. And you just have, you know, practice. I have more on here, so we don't need to click anymore. So this is one that I use for when I train volunteers, and it goes through, like, cross-cultural communication. So if you're really interested, I can go through it, but I don't know if I have time. So that's one way, helping out in the classrooms. And like I said, we have a variety of classes from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the evening, nighttime classes, Friday morning, Saturday morning classes. So if this is something that you're interested, you know, you can come in for an hour, 2 hours, help teach some English, and once a week, once a month, whatever works for you. The other way is our mentorship process. And so the families that come in, I like to try and match them up with an American family to kind of teach them the ropes of navigating Sioux Falls and American life. And just, they have a friend here who, you know, is American, and they're so excited about that. And so, you know, the friends might just come over and visit and talk, or they might cook together and share a meal or play games, or they might go wander the city and see what Falls Park looks like and take them to the mall and show them, or they might help them go grocery shopping. One woman I talked to was in tears one time because when she first came, it was about 3 months in, she went to the store and was looking for salt. And she couldn't remember the word for salt, so she couldn't ask for help. And when she did, she was trying to explain it, and the, like, 15-year-old boy wasn't quite understanding what she was meaning. But, you know, she tried looking in all of it. And what does our salt look like? It's a picture of a girl with an umbrella. So, yeah, that was not a clue to her that that was salt. She's like, I don't know what she thought it was, but not salt. And, yeah, and so she said she spent like 45 minutes just trying to find this. And so it's little things like that. You know, go together. Oh, you need salt? I'll show you where you find it. We find it here. Look at all these spices. Or like showing them, like, don't go to the mall and buy jeans. Here are all these other places that you can find inexpensive clothing, things like thrift stores and things like that. And so, you know, if you're interested, we can do like family membership. So your family works with a family or an individual, one-on-one. We've even done groups like book clubs. I have another group of like 8 people. So it's 8 husbands and wives who are working with a family. And like I said, the client is so, so excited. I took a girl to meet her mentee yesterday, and she was just like, I have an American friend now. I've been here 2 months. I have an American friend now. And just like, I'm so excited to meet people. And, you know, it's very difficult when you're afraid of speaking and getting made fun of to go out. And also, to many of the places that they're qualified to work don't have a lot of Americans working there. And so it's difficult to make those connections and integrate quicker into the community and figure out what's what. And many times they end up, you know, in their own community, not learning English, not making those connections that can lead to better jobs and everything. So that's a really fun one. I mean, we even take just basic donations. You know, when they come, they need the basic supplies, bedding, dishes, towels, cleaning supplies. All of that needs to go into an apartment. And so rather than spend what little money that they get each month to buy that, if we have donations, we can give it to them. And now their funds can last longer, or maybe buy shoes or winter coats for them. And I have a list of that if you're interested. But the easiest thing you can do is just being a welcoming face in the community. If you see them, say hi. If they look confused, ask if they need help, because they're just as terrified to talk with someone as you might be to talk with someone who doesn't know English. So just that smile can be enough to be like, oh, this is my home now. I'm safe here. So that's what I have to say. If you have any questions or comments or anything, I'll be here. I've got paperwork. You know, if you want a list of the things I talked about, I have kind of a summary sheet. So I know some of you are taking pictures. You know, this kind of does all that, so you don't need to do those pictures. If you're interested in those lists of donations that are useful, I have that as well, too. So, but I'll turn it back to Jeff. Thank you.